Welcome back, my friends, to On the Brink, where we never end. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson, recording the show from Central Tasmania once again. It's the 16th of May, and this show is entitled The Electromagnetic Universe, Current Issues and Shocking Anomalies. Now, that's supposed to be kind of a joke based on current, you know, like alternating current, direct current, and shocking anomalies, like they like to say that in Australia. That's it's a bloody shocker. It's a shocker, mate. So, the electromagnetic universe. But first, I'd like to thank everybody for being out there, and my friends, and awake, and caring enough to listen to this show. And all the coronavirus stuff seems to be lightening up, kind of in a to and fro, kind of back and forth, two steps forward, one step backward kind of way. But it does seem to be all improving. International travel still seems like a ways off in the future, but and even interstate travel in Australia is gradually going to be reopening in the next few weeks. But there's more and more weird stuff being released about the whole thing with the vaccines and all. But I mean, to be honest, I'm having an increasingly hard time even letting that stuff into my mind. I keep going like, I just want to focus on the beauty and power of nature and other issues that were issues before this whole thing. I mean, this thing only cropped up. It's only been 2 months ago. 2 months. It seems like a year. Anyway, this show's not about any of that. I'd like to first talk about, before I get on to the electromagnetic thing, is the fact that I don't like to use the word language when referring to how any other beings communicate other than people. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot in the hip, trendy circles of the celebrity experts who want to claim that they're on the verge of quote-unquote cracking the code with dolphins, talking with dolphins. What are they saying to us? We're going to translate it into English. And it's just, even though John Lilly, the illustrious researcher with whom I worked and got to know a little bit, even he occasionally used the word language with respect to whale and dolphin communication. But early on, he differentiated between the terms in the way that I'm doing now. And because I like to use precise terminology, I've gone to a lot of trouble in my research and in my recent shows whenever I talk about words like conspiracy, cybernetics, computers, technology. I like to use the word in its true etymological sense. And the same with language. Language comes from ancient words that has to do with our tongue. Like lingua, linguistics, language, has to do with your tongue and using the tongue for communicating, making sounds. Well, as far as I know, all mammals have tongues. And I'm pretty sure that all birds have tongues, and all reptiles have tongues, and all amphibians have tongues, and probably fish and cephalopods have tongues. I'm not sure they've got, cephalopods have beaks, but many beings have tongues. I don't know if insects do. They've got proboscises and things like that. But as far as I know, even among the mammals that make sounds with their mouth through exhaling, I don't think that any of them use the tongue to any degree to make their sounds, to modify their sounds. Or really, of course they would use their lips, but you, again, it's being a bit analytic. You can't really separate out the larynx from the tongue and the mouth and the lips and the whole sort of apparatus that enables us to make precise and controlled sounds. But we call this language. We call language the way that we communicate using words. And even though there's probably thousands of different human languages, and there's many of them are very, 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 very different, and so different that they can't even really be translated, if only because the whole reason that different cultures communicate with language or sound is different. That's the part that we might not even be able to get our head around, and this is only within human cultures. And you've got the difference between symbolic and harmonic languages, where harmonic languages are how all languages used to be. It was never written down. It was about the sound of the word, the sound of the spoken communication. It was probably much more like music. There was probably not a big differentiation between singing and speaking, or as some people theorize, like Stephen Mithen, who wrote the book The Singing Neanderthals, he said that they communicated by singing. So it's not impossible that there could be languages that were not ever written down that were symbolic, in the sense that you could have a sound that stands for this and a sound that stands for that. So there's not really a clear differentiation, but symbolic languages are ones that, in general, have a word or a sound that represents, signifies, or stands for something else. Whereas the harmonic languages, the sound itself would contain morphogenetically encoded resonance information that sort of expresses the nature of the object or person or process or event that you're trying to communicate about. So that's a whole area there of communication research. But my point is that human language is extremely sophisticated, but it's got a double edge to it. And Korzybski, the linguist, said we must be very careful to not confuse the map with the territory, and that's exactly what we've done so readily. We worship the map, because the map is much simpler. The map is much easier to manipulate, and you can fold it up and put it in your pocket, or you can turn it on and listen to it, or you can spread it out on your table. But what it stands for, the territory, is so infinitely huge and astronomically vast and complex that we can't really grasp the territory. Oh no, our brains and minds aren't big enough for that, and it's a bit overwhelming. So we're satisfied to consume map energy to the point of, it's like if you go in a restaurant and eat the menu rather than the food. That's what we're doing. We're the menu eaters. So a lot of dolphin and whale people, especially some that I used to have a very high degree of respect for as one of the top whale and dolphin threat activists, has now set up shop as a would-be celebrity expert on whale and dolphin speak or language. And I'm not going to go into this too much, but I just had to make a point the other day about why I don't use the word language with whales and dolphins. Language means that you use your tongue to communicate or to make sounds, and they don't do that. Maybe some of the other primates might use their tongue to make some sounds. They certainly don't articulate words like we do, but neither do whales and dolphins. But whales and dolphins don't typically make sound in air, except to us. I mean, there's no way to know that they don't do it in other circumstances when there's no people, but we couldn't possibly know that. But when they make sound, it comes out of their blowhole, the hole in the top of their head through which they breathe. And the equivalent with us, it would be like trying to speak or make sounds through our nose. That's what they do for us, because if they make sounds underwater like they normally do, we can't hear it unless we've got hydrophones or something like that. So the sounds that they make on our behalf are completely unnatural to them. And it's not language. To discriminate between language and communication, that's the crux of what I'm talking about. All beings communicate. All beings communicate in a very sophisticated and truly intelligent ways based on who and what they are. We're the only ones that have weaponized communication and let it fall into disrepair, as it were, as we have with so many of our ultimate technology abilities. But to say that dolphins and whales have language is completely wrong. They have advanced forms of communication, some of which we understand, many of which we share and can use, many of which we are using with them and between them and us all the time, whether we're aware of it or not, like, for example, telepathy, or the fact that, for example, if you've been keeping an animal captive for so long and you keep trying to make it jump through hoops metaphorically, get it to make sounds when you hold up a little sign, and then one day it's just had too much and you get in there and it uses its beak and it rams you in the chest so hard that it almost breaks your ribs. And it could easily have killed you, but no, it didn't do that. It just was just showing you, like, look, dude, I've had enough of this bullshit. So that's exactly what happened with a researcher named John Kurt that was heading up the John Lilly's Human Dolphin Foundation research in Redwood City, the group I worked with. And that happened after Joe and Rosie the Dolphins had already been there 2, 3, 4 years. Somebody that was working there told me about that. They said, Jeff, you need to know this. The dolphins are getting really sick of being held captive. So any work or research or experiments that have been done that in which dolphins give the impression that they're using language, all it is they're jumping through hoops because the people, they like to do what the people want. They like to please people. They want to make you happy. And plus, they're being held captive. It's like Lilly himself said that you can't really expect, what kind of results in communication can you expect from beings that are like being held prisoners in a concentration camp, which is what, I mean, I don't know that any sort of quote-unquote language experiments have been done with dolphins that are not being held captive. How could you? Why would they'd have to stay there long enough to do anything, and I don't think that there, nothing that the people are doing is going to be interesting enough to keep them there. Yeah, that was Lilly's basic premise all along, that he said in his research report to the National Science Foundation that I used to have a copy of, that the whole goal with the Janus configuration and setting up that lab, they were only going to keep the dolphins for a year while they developed the necessary computer hard and software doing the real-time frequency transformations in order to then go and work with free-swimming dolphins from a boat, where it would be their choice to come and go and we'd be in their element rather than vice versa. That never happened. So that put a spin on the whole work. And all other dolphin communication work has been done with captive cetaceans. And so they might kind of give the impression that they're associating this sound or this symbol with this meaning or object and blah, blah, blah. And they can, when you hold this up, then they'll do that, blah, blah, blah. But it's pretty much just kind of simple cause and effect like that. But to me, these people are missing the point. They're completely missing the point. Why bother to analyze their communication or to debate on whether they have language or not? Why not try to understand what it is that they're trying to communicate? That's been my approach all along. And it's the only thing that actually makes sense. These people are completely, they're not about understanding the whales and dolphins. They're about their own trip, their own enterprise, their own nonprofit organization, their own research grant, their own celebrity expert standing, and their ability to use all these terminologies like robust and advocacy and stuff like that I really kind of have a disdain for. So anyway, that's why I don't think or use the term language. I don't think it's correct to refer to any beings other than humans who use language. Communication, yes. Very sophisticated communication, yes. Forms of communication that we don't even understand or can't comprehend, absolutely. But language, no. Only us. Now, I'd also like to honor probably my very favorite Indigenous Australian First Nations elder, Uncle Bob Randall, who I first was told about back in the year 2000 when I was in Byron Bay, and someone I met knew him, and they said, "Jeff, you really need to meet Uncle Bob. You guys would really like each other." And at that time, even Uluru seemed light years away, so I gave them a painted rock, and they said that they would give it to Uncle Bob. And so when I caught up with his widow 3 years ago, Barbara Randall, she had that rock. And so I saw him in a John Pilger documentary called Utopia about 4 years ago. And I was really impressed by his beautiful spirit and his eloquence and his message and what he had to say. And I painted this really, really cool rock for him on a perfect round rock from the South Island of New Zealand, and with an Aboriginal flag and the rainbow serpent, and I determined that I was going to go and give it to him in person. Well, it was taking me a couple of years to get to Uluru, in and out of Australia and around, and by the time before I could get there, he passed away. And he passed away on the 14th of May, 2017. That was the anniversary of his passing, was 3 days ago, and I'd like to honor Uncle Bob and his beautiful legacy and his message of Kanini, kind of like Gandhi's term Satyagraha. It means the power of truth and walking your talk. And anyway, Barbara and also Iris Ray Nunn, who's a woman who knew Uncle Bob, they told me that one of his spirit totems, his totem bird, is the Eastern Rosella, which is a very beautiful kind of parrot that's indigenous to Australia, and there's heaps of them around here where I am now in north central Tasmania. And on the day of his passing, that morning, a Rosella came and sat in the tree really close to my little flat and made the most powerful, intense call. And that I know their sounds very well. They've got many different sounds. They've got kind of little gentle whistlings, and they've got little burblings and sounds they make when they're flying and when they're close. And then they've got this kind of loud, kind of an alert call that they kind of, it's like they're announcing. It's an annunciatory call, like they're like the town crier. It's that kind of thing. And so I really felt, I knew, even though I didn't realize that day was the day of his passing, but I knew that Rosella had a message for me. And then the next day I realized what it was, that he was telling me that was the day of Uncle Bob's passing. And I think of him all the time, and all the First Nations Australians. And also, now a third thing to talk about, there's this comet. There's been two comets in recent months, Comet Atlas and Comet Swan, that have been, they're saying that these are the first two comets that we've detected that did not originate in the solar system. They're from another star system. And so, theoretically, many other comets could be of extrasolar system origin, but just not in the recent past. So we don't really know. There's a lot of interesting models and hypotheses about where comets come from. And that's what I've talked with Victor Klub and Bill Napier about a lot, and hope to, again, the legendary comet researchers. Comet Swan is now apparently visible in the early morning sky just above the sun. It's now in the constellation Triangulum, and it's just become visible low on the horizon in the northern hemisphere. And so I've been trying to get a glimpse of it here, and now that the moon is coming up on new, it'll be a very thin crescent, and if I can get a view of the eastern sky early this morning, like the past few mornings it's been cloudy at that time, but I might be able to see it. And I saw a really cool photograph taken from the Siding Spring Observatory in the Warrumbungles, where I visited about 4 years ago, and it's amazing. And so it looks like a lot of stuff is streaming out off of the tail. It's kind of wavering and stuff like that. And so this brings up the idea that I saw in an article today about, like, one of the things that Bill Napier talks about is that the Earth, we've had meteoric dust in the atmosphere many, many times due to the approach, flyby, or impact from meteors, asteroids, and comets. And it brings in dust into the atmosphere that then can, if it's thick enough, it can change the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth and mess with the climate change and weather and all this different kind of stuff. So I'm really hoping to delve into this a bit more with Victor Klüb. Hopefully he might do an interview with me. So anyway, now that I've been talking for 15 minutes, let's get on to the electromagnetic universe, current issues and shocking anomalies. Now, this is a huge, huge area. We don't really know what electricity is. Back in 2003, when I was painting a mural down in Hobart, it was called Saha Jed. And it was my friend Moira Timms, who wrote a very interesting book. She was an Egyptologist who took people to the Great Pyramid, and she was quite well versed in understanding the hieroglyphic communication system. And so she came up with hieroglyphics for me to use for some of my art and music. And so this one, the hieroglyphics for this one said, "Transforming star lightning awareness into sunrise love." And I remember asking her what the Egyptian hieroglyphic for electricity was. And she says, well, they didn't have one because they didn't have electricity or know it or understand it as we do today. So she gave me the hieroglyphic for lightning. And I thought that was very interesting to think of a whole advanced civilization that didn't have electricity. And that's a huge leap in our mind. I mean, could we conceive? Our whole notion of advanced and civilization is based on things that run on electricity, like computers and all this different kind of stuff. And so it's just really interesting to think of how long life on Earth has existed and thrived without electricity as we know it now. Now, if you really want to define, I'm not making an attempt to totally describe the history of our understanding of electricity. It's too huge. It wouldn't fit in one show, and it's been done by many other people. But I'm leading up to the health and ecological impacts of electricity as we know it. But ultimately, we don't really know what it is. We describe it as the flow of electrons. And we describe this. It's a map called the electromagnetic spectrum, and we're right in the middle. What we call visible light is right in the middle, and all the way to infinity, going towards higher frequencies and shorter wavelengths. And then to infinity in the other direction, going towards lower frequencies and longer wavelengths. As far as we can perceive, in the same way that when we look out into space, we see forever, and things can get bigger and bigger and bigger, the universe. And then when we look down small into the micro world through a microscope, things get tinier and tinier and tinier. So we happen to be right in the center of that, of the size scale. And we're also right in the center of time, because if we look into the future or into the past, or actually out sideways in terms of the simultaneity of this exact moment, we can see infinitely in every direction. So it's really funny how we're right in the center of all this, but that's because all this is a projection of our own cognitive cartography, the experiencing I of us individually and us collectively that I portray in my Ultimate Technology spacecraft control panel for your brain. All these are maps or information display of aspects, artifacts of our frames of reference of perception and creativity. And so the electromagnetic spectrum is one of these maps where we're sort of quantifying some of the characteristics of these frames of reference. In this case, the energetic vibrations that we primarily perceive as light. And almost all of that light before the modern era of electricity is from the sun, which is a star. The star that's closest to us that makes all of life possible. And so the only other light that we ever had before the age of electricity was from fire, or maybe lightning bugs, or bioluminescent algae, but fire, which is a plasma. But that's also what a starlight is. So really, plasma has been the only sources of light until the modern era. There was a guy named Maxwell who sort of unified electricity and magnetism, seeing that they were intertwined, that any magnetic field generates electricity and any moving electricity generates a magnetic field. And his work was an essential foundation for Einstein's work with general and special relativity. And so then I'm not sure exactly all about the earliest uses of electricity and how people would generate it and stuff like that, but I do know that probably the single biggest name associated with electricity in the modern world is Nikola Tesla. And I do know that he, in order to get large amounts of electricity, he didn't know how to generate it. So he built his lab at a place called Ames, Colorado, up on a plateau way up in the southern Rocky Mountains near a town called Telluride, where I used to live. And this is where he generated alternating current for the first time. And he put his lab there because there's a tremendous amount of gold ore in the ground. And gold is highly conductive of electricity. And the lightning there had or has unusually powerful properties. So he put his lab there so he could get lightning bolts from thunderstorms and capture them and charge up his apparatus for a while and do experiments on these surges of electricity. So he first generated alternating current at this lab. And Thomas Edison, who he worked for a while, was more of a fan of direct current. So the alternating current flickers on and off at 50 or 60 cycles per second, whereas direct current is just a solid, non-oscillating current. And I don't really understand the pros and cons, but as I understand it now, alternating current with its oscillating, flickering frequency is more dangerous to biological life forms than direct current in terms of just being close to its magnetic field and its ambient impact. So what we've come to with the electrification of the world and everything that's happened because of electricity, we've basically electrified the whole planet. If you think of where electricity is, or where it's not, but anywhere people live, it's just saturated with electricity. There's the power lines and all the stuff. And this is just back up to like the time of World War II. You've got telephone transmission lines, which also have electric current. you've got the high tension power lines, and you've got the ways of generating the power, all the hydroelectric and coal-fired facilities and the nuclear power reactors. So the whole thing with planetary electricity is absolutely huge. People think it's almost as essential as oxygen. And for a lot of stuff it is. I mean, you're not going to run a computer off of oxygen. It needs electricity. So we think that we have to have electricity for our lights to see at night, to cook our food, to keep us warm, to run our radios and our appliances and our power tools and our electric toothbrush and all this stuff. But imagine that there's still indigenous people in the world now that don't have electricity. They don't have anything electric. They don't need it. And then all the other life forms. No other species of life uses electricity except for humans. Other species of life are affected by it, like you see the moths going around the lamps and different kind of things like that, but they didn't create it. They're just sort of like being affected as a secondhand kind of byproduct. So it's one of the ways in which we've begun to not just domesticate ourselves, but to induce mutation in our own species. So the primary issue that I'm addressing with this show is how that with the whole electrification of the planet and what we call technological civilization, we've created a new type of mutagenic influence on ourselves and all of life. And we've been exposed, we're talking about radiation, and we've broken it down into ionizing radiation and non-ionizing radiation. And so all the energy that comes from the sun is radiation. We've got, and then we call it electromagnetic radiation. And what we call electricity is part of this. So it's essential to life. And I think one of the most interesting insights about electricity is that, and I think I originally heard this from Dr. Nick Begich, the doctor from Alaska who sort of told us about HARP before it ever even existed, the microwave ionospheric heater. In one of his books, he said that all chemical reactions are electrical, and which is very profound when you think about it, but it makes sense at the level of the atom, with the electrons and the protons and the neutrons, as we have conceived it in this story that we call science. All the electrons are bound to the atom because of their electrical charges. And they've got different levels of charges, and there's different levels of electrons with different charges and stuff. And so all the force that binds the subatomic particles together, well, you've got the strong and weak nuclear force, and you've got gravity, but electromagnetic, the electrical or magnetic force is what has to do with the electrons, which are the particles that are shared by atoms of the same type or other to form compounds, molecules. And so all these forces that involve shared electrons are electrical. And so anything that's electrical in our environment can potentially affect matter at the level of the atom, and all chemical processes too. So it's really interesting to think of how the artificial electrical environment that we've pretty much all been living in since, well, everyone who's alive now, pretty much all of our lifetime and ever since, oh, probably around World War I, I'm guessing most people had electricity and radios and TVs and light bulbs and things like that. But if you think of the increasing saturation of electricity in all its different forms, artificial electromagnetic radiation, which in the world of today includes not only radio and television transmissions, but also microwaves, which is huge. That's a huge health effect individually and across all of life. But if you think of the fact that not only are we creating a mutagenic environment for ourselves and all of life based on this energy, it may also be affecting chemistry in ways that we don't really even understand or aren't even looking for. Like the presence, I mean, I'm sure this is probably research that's been done in the field of what might be called electromedicine or something like that, but the understanding of how electromagnetism affects chemical processes. I know a lot of research has been done on how it affects biological processes, but about chemical reactions, the presence of electrical fields or magnetic fields. I don't know, it's very interesting to think about, but we've created, along with the whole nuclear thing, the radiological scenario, after we split the atom and started creating 2,000 synthetic radionuclides and saturating the whole biosphere with these fission byproducts. And then the revolution in chemistry after World War II that was founded on industries that were designing weapons. In the same way that a lot of byproducts of the space program made their way into the household, a lot of substances that were weapons became useful in different ways, like, for example, DDT. Things that would kill people, like nerve gas, would also kill insects, and vice versa. And so, Rachel Carson, who's one of my top heroes of humanity, talked about the mutagenic characteristics of nuclear substances and chemicals. But back in her time in the early 60s, the whole thing with electromagnetism was still, it was in the military. You know, we had electricity, we had telephones, we had radios, we had TVs, but we didn't really have microwaves, and radar was still a thing that only the military had. But scientists, especially in the Soviet Union, were already extremely aware of what this meant for biology as we know her, that it's not good. So then, jump ahead to the world of now and how the whole electromagnetic saturation has increased exponentially over short periods of time with the whole dawn of mobile phones, the telecommunications industry that really sort of started really becoming huge around the mid-90s. I remember a dude, like anybody that had a mobile phone back then was like rich. I remember seeing there was this dude that owned a radio station, and his mobile phone, it was like the size of a small backpack. And oh my God, I mean, who can guess what kind of energetic emissions that thing had? But I remember seeing it, and it was, you know, I was never interested in having one, or it didn't really appeal to me. And so then, all through the early 2000s, everybody started getting mobile phones, and I had a great disdain for them. I knew what they were and how dangerous they were with the microwaves, and I would object if somebody sat to me next to me on the train and started talking to it and holding it up next to my head. I actually got in arguments with people about that kind of thing. And then in 2012, I actually got one myself. It was, I've almost never had to buy one. People give them to me. They give me their old ones before they throw away their Nokia Lumia so they can get a new Apple smartphone. I've never had one that's even remotely new, and I like it that way. But so I use a mobile phone now. I rarely make calls, and if I do, they're short, and I try to never hold it next to my head unless it's just impossible. I mean, in my mind, I'm as aware as anybody of the health effects and the negative influences of these microwave things. But to me, it's a lesser of two evils because I can't have a landline living on the road. And so the mobile phone is my only way to communicate in that kind of way. So I use it sparingly. I'm constantly monitoring the Wi-Fi signal that I use to go online. And it's very minimal. I've got a microwave meter that shows me exactly what it is. Now, this meter doesn't show 5G. But so anyway, we've saturated we've electrified the planet, mainly thanks to Nikola Tesla. We've got these millions of high-tension power lines strung everywhere through every city and town and neighborhood and out in the country and across the field and down across the floor of the ocean. And we've got all these satellites up in space, and we've got all the military vehicles and all the transmitters, the television and radio stations, and all the computer internet transmitters and all this difference. I mean, you know, to map out the global electrical scenario would just be, it would almost be like on the order of, say, like if you were going to count the number of grains of sand on a beach, how many electrical appliances and things that run on electricity there are. But suffice it to say that we've extraordinarily saturated the biosphere of Mother Earth with electricity, artificial electricity, not the natural electricity of lightnings, which happen about, I think there's probably thousands of lightning strikes per hour happening all around the Earth. It's like the Earth has been described as a capacitor because of the charges that are constantly built up and discharging between the different layers of the atmosphere. So Mother Earth is very electrical herself, and the geophysical weapon specialists like Gordon MacDonald have been very aware of this. So this is what the whole generation of geophysical warfare is based on: the microwave electromagnetic manipulation of the Earth's atmosphere to affect weather, climate, tectonic, and seismic activity, among other things. And then we've got the fact that we're essentially electromagnetic. We have auras, we have electrical currents happening in our brains. We've got our nervous systems that are discharging, and Mother Earth has her own telluric currents flowing through her body, through the ore bodies that we dig out. So with all our digging precious things from the land, the mining, disrupting these telluric processes and disrupting them in our environment, disrupting them in our body through the presence of artificial fields and emanations, and the constant overlap and the synergetic interaction between all these things, and the fact that Arnold Lehman, who was a genetic toxicologist, a colleague of Rachel Carson, he said in the early 60s that if we really want to understand the mutagenic effects of all these substances like chemical or radionuclides, and we could extend that to electromagnetic influences as well, we need to study at least 25 generations of people. And so we who are alive now are only the third generation of people to exist, really, since all this stuff came into existence. So we are the experiment. And so, like, now we're going to the next level with Elon Musk's Starlink satellites that want to beam all this 5G stuff down to the Earth and have a million ground transmitters, and the fact that they want a DARPA and the military Pentagon police state surveillance mob want every person to have an implantable or injectable radio frequency identification device, kind of like a nano quantum dot implant that'll allow you to be identified and tracked. And then beyond that it might have some kind of nanotechnology that might try to rearrange us genetically. And all of this is happening on the Earth while we're constantly being bombarded by energy from the sun, not just the beautiful warm sunshine, but also the solar wind and coronal mass ejections that come out that influence the electromagnetic aspects of the Earth and her aura and her atmosphere, her magnetosphere and ionosphere, and things like the Carrington event that happened in the 1800s when a giant solar flare spewed out all this energy and it made telegraph lines burst into flame. So then we might have the random wave arriving from a supernova that sends a blast of cosmic radiation. And then we've got emanations from planets and comets and asteroids that might have caused discharges visible in the sky of ancient times. Emmanuel Wielikowski calls it, people would have thought of it as Theomachy, War of the Gods. And Anthony Perot of Los Alamos National Laboratory is going around the world studying the rock art that looks like plasma discharges. It looks like the little squatting man. Everything I've just been talking about relates to the electric environment. We've got the whole idea of not only computers, but artificial intelligence and all that that entails and everything that's made possible. It's the operating environment for what Gerrymander calls megatechnology. But none of this stuff, the Manhattan Project, the nuclear weapons, much less HARP and all the geophysical weapons, television, artificial intelligence, none of this stuff, nothing that depends on computers would be possible without electricity. But I know what it's like to live without electricity, and I'm not talking about the bioelectricity, the microcurrents in our body, and the auras of the plants, and the light from the stars. All this is electromagnetic radiation, but I'm talking about what it's like to live without artificial human electricity. My partner, Lisbon, and I did this for about 6 weeks, and then again for about 4.5 months on Flinders Island, Tasmania in 2008 and 2009, and then in 2011. So we came to know what it's like to not be around any artificial electricity, and it's really good. It makes your whole system change. You become much more sensitive and open. You're not trying to block out something that your body doesn't like. Your body becomes open like a sponge to all the energies and the delicate emanations and vibrations of life, the divas and the songs of the birds and the bees and the sound of the wind and the ocean. And it's like your whole body, it's like we are, you really feel that we really are a very supremely crafted antenna, a multi-dimensional energetic antenna for all kinds of the full spectrum of the whole tapestry of creation that's communicating and sharing with us, and we're able to be connected. And you can talk about scientific formulations of a frequency called the Schumann resonance, which is like 7.86 cycles per second and happens to be the same as the alpha frequency of our brain. Well, this is kind of like the heartbeat of Mother Earth. And so all of these artificial vibrations and energies are superimposed over the top of this. And it's a constant battle. So I think that one of the best things we can do in the world of today is spend as much time in nature as possible, out and away from electromagnetic influences. Like, turn your mobile phone off and leave it at home. Go and camp out for a few days. And also, being near or preferably in the ocean is also a great way to protect and cleanse yourself, because electrical technology and seawater really do not get along at all. My Nikon camera that got doused, and my other little video camera that got doused in Rarotonga 2 years ago are testaments to this fact. Instantly corrosion sets in. So be in tune with water. Turn off the electrical stuff. We can use it for what it is. You know, we don't have to be obsessed with being online all the time in the same way that we don't have to be obsessed with the necessity of trying to impose the use of language on other beings who don't have language. They communicate, you know, so we don't have to do everything. We don't have to live exclusively in the electrified planet syndrome. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off. Go out and try to find Comet Swan this morning and swim in a nice body of water, the ocean or a river. Breathe deeply the beautiful oxygen, feel the gravity and the sunlight and the spirit of friendship of all the beautiful families of life that we have. And give thanks for the past few weeks. We've had a break from our daily routine, and it's been a chance to pause and reflect and hopefully not stress too much about what's not going to come back to the way it was. And a lot of it's good, but it's basically up to us what we're going to get, because we're creating it through our active use of our own internal technology or our relinquishment of the responsibility of being and having and existing as that ultimate technology. This is a time to seize the day and be who we really are as the people of one heart, the passengers, crew of Mother Earth, not the Homo sapien macrovirus. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off from Northern Tasmania. Good night.